actually, that we were in the middle of a bloody revolution. The last person to go was Yzebel.
I don't remember her going.
Yeah, the dogs ate her, remember? Did we discuss her? I thought we discussed her.
I think we
she
were
put on the makeup. She put on the makeup on her face, and she went in that way. I think that was the end of the Perek Tet. So we started the Yehu revolution last time. I'm sorry, what? You were saying? You traveled
no,
out for a...
No, I wasn't here the last time before Yantan because it was too busy a season.
All right, sure.
Malachim Beis.
So then I'll give everybody a little bit of a refresher. It's Malachim Bet. Perek Yud. And what I'll do, because I know it's been 2 weeks, is I'll give a 5-minute refresher on what's going on. Ahab's time is up. It's actually not Ahab, it's Ahab's son, Yehoram. The first son was Ahaziah, he's the one who fell through the floor. Good evening. So he's the one who fell through the trap door, so to speak, and broke his leg. He was the klutz. Yehoram came to power and he did it okay. He went up to battle against Aram and got hurt, and then he went to heal himself in a place in Yisrael. It was a place where he could heal himself. He was visited by his brother-in-law named Ahaziah, the king of Yehuda. And at this time, Elisha gets the word that he's supposed to send a prophet over to Yehu, who was a general in the armies of the north fighting against Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, Aram. And he goes in, he says, "You're going to be the next king." Everybody agrees to this. He comes back. He kills the northern king, Yoram. Remember, they kept on sending messengers out to them. And the messengers would say, "Hashalom, is there peace?" And he would say, "Malacha l'shalom tasov me'acharai," which means, forget about the peace. If you want to live, be on my side. And that happened the successive times. And what the indication was is that there's a grassroots rebellion, finally. People are sick and tired of Ahab's house. Because his sons, the truth is, you know, we're all fickle people. When a home run hitter is hitting home runs, we like him. But when he stops hitting home runs, so we boo him out of the stadium. So as long as Ahab's alive, he was such a successful king, it was a little hard to lead a grassroots rebellion. And the truth is, Eliyahu didn't even try. He wasn't trying grassroots rebellion. He was trying a frontal assault on the religious problems. It was unsuccessful. Elisha, however, what we saw over the course of 5 chapters, from chapter 2 to chapter 8, was that he was convincing people that he was a good guy. He was retraining the VM, he was helping poor people, he was helping women and the sick, and his own doing little tiny miracles to create a grassroots sensation. So what happens is that it works when Yehu comes around and he's told by one of the prophets that you have to be the king. He says, okay. When Yehu tells the other generals who are no lower than he is on the totem pole, they said, okay, if that's what God says. And every person who confronts Yehu is on Yehu's side against the house of Ahab. And they kill Ahab's son Yehoram. They kill the king of Yehuda who is with him, who's married in. His wife was Ahab's daughter, so essentially a brother-in-law. His name was Ahaziahu. They come to Yzebel's house in Shomron, and Yzebel puts on makeup and tries to put on a little play. She accuses Yehu of being just another guy named Zimri, who's just another murderer, and Yehu's not buying, and he has the people in her own house throw her out the window, which is, again, kind of grassroots. That is, had she was held up in a tower, had she been held up in a tower, he may have had a hard time getting there, but that wasn't the issue so much. The more important issue was he spoke to the other people in the tower who were ostensibly on Yzebel's side, and they said, chuck her out the window, and they did. So again, you have a situation where there's grassroots rebellion, and the days of Ahab's house are over.
That's how she died. Huh?
Yeah, that's how she threw her out the window, and then he ran her over with his chariot, and then the dogs ate her body, leaving only her head, her arms, and her feet, and he decided that he was going to bury her out of apparent respect to the fact that she was a princess of Lebanon, and by the time they got there, there was nothing left to bury, and that's essentially where we left off. So these 2 chapters I call Yehu's Bloody Revolution, but we're not over yet. The real bloodshed starts in chapter 10. Ul'achav shivim banim b'shomron. And it's very interesting how methodical chapter 10, 2 Kings, Malachim Bet, verse 1. It's very interesting how methodical, how much attention is paid to detail. Usually, for instance, when there was a revolution against the house of Baasha, who Ahab took over from, more or less, there was a guy named Zimri who had him killed, and then there was a fight, and eventually, Omri, and Omri's house, Baasha was the one who died. Omri took over, but essentially you don't really get a lot of details of the rebellion. Essentially, there was a rebellion, end of story. I think perhaps in the same kind of let's pay attention to detail that we have in throughout Elisha's writings, we pay a great deal of attention to the detail of the rebellion here with Elisha. I can't say for sure that's Elisha's style, but we're going to see that it really goes into details about, you can almost write a handbook here about how to lead a proper grassroots rebellion. So you figure after the king is dead, so then that's it, and then Yehu takes over. But it's not so simple as it isn't in real life. Usually Tanakh ignores this type of thing, just not interested in the details. But Elisha or his prophets are, and they write the following story. Ulachab shivim banim b'shomron, vayichtov Yehu sfarim vayishlach shomron el sarei Yisrael hazakinim, ve'el ha'omenim, achav lemor. So what he does is, Ahab has 70 sons. Probably Lav Davka, not specifically 70. 70 is usually just a number that means a lot. If you remember, Gidon had 70 sons who were killed by their brother Avimelech, and the number 70, I think, is more indicative of a whole lot, which makes sense. Ahab was a busy king over, I believe, 27 years, I believe he ruled. I'm sure his only wife was not Izebel, and therefore he probably had a whole bunch of kids. Whether it was exactly 70 or not is not really significant, and probably the answer is no. But the bottom line is he had a whole bunch of kids, any which of whom can claim to the throne. Exactly right. So he takes care of them.
Where is Yisrael?
So Yisrael is not Yisrael, of course. Yisrael, we came into contact with Yisrael. If you remember, that was where Navot lived. Navot had the vineyard, and Ahab goes up, and it turns out that Navot was the head of this town called Yisrael, and there was quite a political conflict between the two, and Ahab has them killed. On a map, Yisrael would still be in the Harei Shomron, and I would say probably not too far from Jenin of today. The valley of Jezreel is a valley which separates the lower Galilee. Hi, good evening.
Sorry, I'm late.
Oh, please. I'm glad. Does it list the city of Jezreel there?
Here. Yeah, the valley.
Is it? So that's the valley of Jezreel.
Near Kadesh.
Yeah, that's where modern day Afula Beit Shan is where the valley is today. The question is that where the city of Yisrael is? My guess is it was probably still in the mountains because it was a fortified city and you didn't put fortified cities really down in the mountain. Probably it was on the slopes going down to the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley is a very fertile land that separates the southern Galilee to the north, where you have Megiddo, probably to the north and other places, and the mountains of Shomron, what we call modern-day Samaria. The city, my guess, would be close to Jenin of today, which is on the foothills going down. I don't know if you've ever driven it, by the way. Has anybody ever, when I was in Israel in the 80s, was anybody ever in Shiloh in the 80s? There's a town called Shiloh. If you're driving north, you used to go through the what? Oh, sorry. There's still a town. There's still a city, and you would drive there going towards Shechem. And after you got through Shechem, there was this windy road that went essentially down a cliff, and it went like this. I don't know if anybody knows what I'm talking about. And essentially, when you got to the top of the mountain, there's a place called Maale Levona, which is the highest mountain. And then you look down on the Jezreel Valley, which is all wheat and other kinds of farming. And there was this really frightening cliff that would. And of course, Israeli bus drivers were taking it, while they were, reading a newspaper with one hand and drinking coffee with the other hand. So they would whip around these really vicious turns going around. So it was a little bit scary. So that's really probably where Jezreel was. What is it named after? It probably is named after Zerah, which means to plant or to seed, because that whole valley was a seeded valley, and they probably named the. I would guess it was a city that overlooked the valley and therefore had control militarily over the valley, and they probably called the name of the city after the name of the valley, which was after its function. So that's Jezreel.
Is it on this map?
It should be. It is. Here's Shiloh. It would be around here where it says Mount Gerizim, a little bit lower than. Here's Shechem, I'm sorry. Here's Tirzah. So it's right around here in the Beit Shan Valley, a little bit north of Beit Shan Valley. So essentially you have the elders and you have the trainers. You probably recognize that word Oman from Megillat Esther. Vayhi Omen et Esther Hadasahi Esther. Omen means a trainer, which means that he had children. He probably had anywhere from teenagers down to little babies. And he sends a message. He says like this. It's a very strange pasuk. V'ata bivoa sefer aleichem, as this letter reaches you, v'itchem b'nei adoneichem, and by you have the children of your master, that is, the children of Achav. V'itchem arechev asusim, and you know what? You also have control over the chariots and the horses. V'ir mivtsar, and you also have control over the walled cities. V'hanashek, and also you have swords. You have essentially the supplies. You are in charge of the smithy. So essentially he says, I want to recognize something right away. You've got the children, you've got the cities, you've got the armies, you've got everything going for you. And you will find the best of your master's children, that is, you'll find a replacement. The Samtem al Kiseh Aviv, and you will place him on the seat of his father, you will enthrone him. The Hilachamu al Beit Adonichem, and you will fight for your master's seat, for your master's house. That's the end of the letter. So the Radak says, it sounds like he's giving them good advice. What he is doing is he's intimidating them. He's saying, I'll give you the following plan, why don't you see if it works out for you? And that's what Radak is saying. Here, you have the money, you have the weapons, you have the horses and the chariots, you've got the guy, and why don't you come out and fight with me? And it's a very, the truth is you just don't get detail like this in Tanakh. It's a very, you really get a sense of the political passion going into the story here. Again, everything in Elisha's little book is really quite distinctive. Vayiru ma'od ma'od. Even that is really, that's quite the day. We're really, 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 really afraid. You don't really get that very much, you know. Are they more, when you just get in Tanakh, a lot of times it says by Yerum Ma'od. Were they not really afraid, but these guys were more afraid? I suspect it's really just a style issue. Vayomru, and they said, Hine Shnei Hamalachim, Lo Amdu Lefanav. These two, they wrote back and they said, listen, you were able to take out these two kings without a fight. That is Ahaziah of the king of Yehuda, and Yoram, the king of Israel. The Echna Modanach, we have no chance against you. So essentially, they back down. It was a bluff or a threat. They back away. Vayishlach Asher al Abayif Asher al Ir Vazkinim Vaomnim al Yehu Lemor. So they all send a letter to Yehu saying, Avdecha Anachnu V'chol Asher Tomar Aleinu Naseh. You're the boss. Okay, you got this. It's more of the same that we've seen before. It's this grassroots rebellion. Instead of, he doesn't have to fight at all. Because if he does, then he's got a civil war in his hands, like we had when Omri took over. What he does is he forces, I mean, it's a gamble, but what he tries is, if he could convince the leaders not to fight, the grassroots not to fight, he's already got the grassroots, if he can convince the leaders now not to fight, so essentially he's pulled off a bloodless revolution. I always call it Yehu's bloody revolution, because certainly all the royalty dies. But on the other hand, it's a very bloodless revolution because there's no actual internecine fighting. There's no civil war, which is very crucial. So it says, "Lo namlich ish atova anecha asei." We will not crown a person, which means we won't create a standard bearer. The minute you crown a person, so you have some people who were, you have some Democrats, you have some Republicans. It's just always the way it is. Whenever you take an issue, I know it's always curious. On any issue, mostly people usually divided anywhere from 50-50 to 65-35. I think it's just the nature of people. You give people two choices, and you're going to have a little bit here and a little bit there. I don't know if that's true or not. It's just always the way it seems to me that nobody ever gets behind something like 100%. Vayichtov aleihem sefer shenit lemor. So he sends him another letter. Im lo atem ulkoli atem shomim. Im li atem. If you're really mine and you're listening to my voice, chu et rashei anshei bnei adanichem. Now this is, you have to read this carefully. Take the heads of the people of the children of your master. Which means it sounds like it's not Achav's children, it's the people of Achav's children. But that's not how to read this. The way to read this is like this. Kru et rashei anshei adonechem. Who are anshei adonechem? I don't want you, the people who follow Achav, or follow Achav, I want just the banim. So what he's saying, so there's a, you don't get it here. The truth is, even you don't even get it in the trope, because the trope connects with the word b'nei to Adonichem. But that's not, really, it should be like in two m-dashes. It should be k'hu et rashei anshei, i.e., b'nei, comma, Adonichem. Do you follow what he's saying? So he's not... That is, the pasuk literally reads, take the people of the children of your masters. That is, take the people of the princes. It sounds like he's not asking for the princes, he's asking for the people who work for the princes. But what you have to... essentially, b'nei is modifying anshei. B'nei is saying, which anshei? It's the b'nei. I just want the children. I don't want anybody else. Uvo elai keit machar Yisrael. And I want you to take all those children. I want you to bring them here to me.
The children or their heads?
Well, he doesn't say their heads.
Oh, I think the...
Maybe that's implication, but he never... What's that?
That's Rashi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I tell you, chuet Rashi anshei. You're right. Take the heads. You're absolutely right. He tells them to cut off their heads. Right. Uvo elai. Thank you. Uvo elai keit machar Yisrael. And come to me. Uvnei amel shivim ish et gedolei... et gedolei ha'ir migadolim otam. And there were 70 who the elders were raising, migadolim they were raising. They killed every single one of the offspring of Achav. Vayasimu et rashehem badudim. They put them in baskets. That's where the dude is. What's that? It's pretty gruesome, right? Vayishlechu elav Yisraela, and they sent him to Yisraela. Vayavo hamalach vayagid lo lemor. So the messenger comes. Aviu rashei bnei hamelach. They brought the heads of the princes. Vayomer simu atam shnei tziburim petach hashar ad aboker. So put them in two big stacks, right next to the gates of the city, until the morning. It's pretty gruesome, right? It's pretty gruesome. Now here he says something very interesting. Again, there's an attention to detail here which is unusual. He turns to his own people and he says, listen, you're righteous. Hine ani kasharti al adoni va'ahargehu. I'm the one, you guys are all righteous. I'm the one who killed the king. I think what he's saying is, you don't have to feel any guilt here. You didn't do anything wrong. Which is, he now has all kinds of people, many of whom were backers of the king. I'm thinking, but I'm not sure, that there's a sense of guilt afterwards. That is, after the blood is out and the bloodlust is out, they're looking around and going, oh my God, we just killed the king. And he's saying to them, no, no, you didn't do a thing. It was all on my hands. I did the deed, and therefore you don't have the guilt. Tzadikimatem, you were righteous. Otherwise, I can't understand exactly, I mean, if that's not what's going on, I'm not sure exactly what the implication is. Why is he telling them that they are righteous? Does the well, let me finish the pasuk and then I'll ask you whether your text has comments. Your text very often has comments in it. So, Vargeu umikar kol eile, and then he says, and who killed all these people? That is, all these heads. And what he's saying is, I didn't do it. I mean, or certainly you didn't do it. It was their own.
I guess they just fell off.
Yes, they sneezed too hard. Now, is there a comment? Lee, is there a comment on this, on verse 9, about why he's telling them that they're righteous? Go ahead, what's the comment?
You consider yourselves all righteous, and then you consider what his sins are to the king. Now look, behold, I revolt against my master and slew him. Who slew all these? But from these you shall know then that it is the decree of the king upon them.
Right, and that goes into the next pasuk. But does it explain why he's trying to convince the people that they're fine and he's not? Does it, is there a comment on the bottom or something which... oh, so there's more... So let me read the next passage because they may be more righteous and I'll get you in a second. De'u'efo, therefore you should know, ki lo yipo midvar adonai arza, that is, based on this, you should know that the word of God will not fall down. Asher diber adonai al beit achav, adonai asad et asher diber bi'ad avdo Eliyahu. So God did what he said he was going to do, and Eliyahu said, you're all dead. But I don't understand how that... fine. But how does that prove...
This is what I have.
What do you have?
We are righteous. It's here employed in the legal sense of innocence. There he said, to reassure the people who were appalled and conscience stricken by the sight of the massacre, fearing that God's punishment will come upon them. I conspired. Yehu justifies his action on the grounds that the destruction of Ahab's was ordained by God.
So you have to read the pasuk.
And that he was destined. Yes, he was the destined instrument for the execution of the divine decree.
See, that means that you have to read verse 10 a little differently. Verse 10 sounds like, based on what I did, you know that what God said is right. It's not like that. It's backwards. You, the people, are guiltless because you didn't do anything. I, in fact, did all the work. But on the other hand, I personally had a nevuah from God that I was supposed to do the work. So I'm innocent, not innocent, but I'm justified, let's say, in the sense that I was commanded. You, who are not commanded, have no problem because you didn't pull the trigger, and therefore you don't have that problem. So again, it's a way, I think, of convincing people that essentially everybody is all, I'm okay, you're okay. Remember that book from the, what was that, from the 70s, I'm okay, you're okay.
Not only are we okay, but that... but this is the way it was supposed to be, because Eliyahu told Eliyahu right.
Correct, but I was just curious.
That's
if it was the will of God,
that Eliyahu had told him.
I told him, but the only thing about that is there must be something a little more than that, because if it was the will of God, then they shouldn't be guilty either. Why does he have to emphasize?
No, he says they're not guilty
because he did the killing. But if it's all okay because God said so, so it wouldn't make a difference who pulled the trigger. I'm sorry, what do you...
Yeah,
but he was destined to be the agent.
Just me. So I was innocent because I was the only agent. You're innocent because you let me do all the work. That's what I think the verses mean. Do you have to?
Yeah, so I think Chutz or She Anshe is an idiom similar to the one
which
used
in what person?
In Vav. So it's similar to the one used by Yosef, right? If you look back to Bereshit.
God, what does it mean?
So with Yosef, he used it twice. For Sar Mashkim, one for Sar Ophim.
And
once both mean different things. So I think here there might have been a mistake that Yehu might have meant something like bring them here and I'm going to intimidate them more, and they misinterpreted and they killed them. That's why he had to say, "Oh, you guys are okay." You might have misinterpreted what I said,
but you're so fine. That's the famous. It's very good. It's the famous joke, by the way. It's actually it makes you laugh every time you read Sefer Bereshit. So the two guys come to him, the wine bearer and the baker. And the wine bearer comes over and he says, "What does my dream mean?" And God says, and Yosef says to him, "In 3 days God will raise your head back to your place, Hu Yishah Roshcha," and put it back on the throne, as in a good thing. And then the baker comes over and he tells the story. He goes, What do you think will happen to me? And he says, "Boshlo Shemim Yishah Roshcha," and the baker's probably going, "Yay!" And then he says, "Me'al Rosh, you know, Me'al Lecho," which means, and then you're dead. And he's like, "Oh." So it's actually, I don't know if Yosef did it on purpose. It's kind of a mean thing to do. He starts off with the same prophecy, Yishah Roshcha, which can mean a good thing, and then he says, "Me'al Lecho," and then he says, "Oh, you're going to die." So it makes a laugh. I don't know whether God had a sense of humor or Yosef had a sense of humor, but it's pretty funny. So I think what Chaim wants to say here is that theoretically, are you saying that he left it ambiguous, or he actually did not want them killed?
I think he might have just wanted to continue to intimidate them. I don't know. If he wanted to kill them, he would have like done it immediately because he already had the people behind him.
It is certainly possible that Chuat Rashi An Shei B'nei Adonichem simply means take them, because to raise somebody's head does mean to raise them up in status. I guess there are three ways to go. Either one is he wanted them dead, for sure. In which case, the only justification that he has here... Well, correct, but maybe he... Well, that's true. He wants them dead anyway. I mean, he kills the king. He's going to kill the king. He's going to kill the children.
Not
unless you don't kill the children because they're not... If they're willing to abrogate the throne, then maybe you let them go.
Yeah, but they may not be...
So I think there are three possibilities here. Either he's really willing to let them go and he just feels that he has the right to kill Ahav and nobody else. In which case, when they wind up dead, he's trying to say it wasn't my fault, and that's what he means in Pasuk Tet when it says Umihi ka kol eile, and who killed all these. He doesn't mean you guys didn't kill them, I did. He means none of us did, it was them, and I didn't mean such a thing. The other possibility, he's being specifically ambiguous because he knows probably how it will be interpreted, but it gives him wiggle room to say, well, I didn't do anything here. It's possible. It seems a little bit dishonest, but it's not impossible that a capable politician would be able to say somewhere down the road, "Hey, weren't you the king? Weren't you the king who wiped out all those sons, 70 innocent kids?" He's like, "That wasn't what the message said. It's cover your rear type of situation." And there, or like Chaim is saying, is that he really did not mean to have them killed at all. He just wanted them pulled to him. Maybe he'd speak to them. That seems a little bit too innocent for me. I tend to be a little more suspicious guy. I'm wondering whether it was a kind of a double entendre, whether he left it open and he's trying to say, "Listen, it wasn't really my fault. They could have not interpreted that way or not killed them." But either way, it's an interesting idea. But I think one of those things is going on here, and I can't say for sure which one it is. Yud Aleph. Vayachi hu et kol hanisharim beit achav. This is also where it's a little hard to say that he was really being nice, because after this he goes out, he wipes out everybody else that's related to Achav, cousins, sisters, beshmet, you name it, he takes them out. Be Yisrael, v'chol gdolav u'myuda'av v'chol anav. He takes down every one of his elders, every one of his people that knew him, obviously some kind of high position. The Chohanav, in this case, the Targum, the Aramaic, translates as friends, which we've seen before in Sefer Melachim. Not Kohanim, but friends. Ad bilti hishir lo sarid, until he had nobody left. Vayakam vayav. So that's essentially up to this point. We now have no more. There's nobody left in the house of Acham. Now, by the way, this didn't happen in one day. That pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayakam here, we call in Nisharim, obviously took a while. You go here, you go there. He hunted them down until they were gone, so they would pose no threat. The pasuk looks like it happens like that, but I think that's not the sense of what's going on. He had the 70 kids killed essentially right away, and afterwards, what it's saying is he went around and finished the business.
Sounds like he was the Nazi of his era.
It was, well, you know, that's...
These people, like, left and right.
He took out... The Navi is backing him here. Well, I know it's backing him and not backing him. It's not really... The Navi's not really saying, you know, and this was good in the eyes of the Lord, and this was bad in the eyes of the Lord. It's letting him say, this is what God wanted me to do. But the Navi's certainly not contradicting him. The question is, if I kill a bad guy, am I bad? If I kill somebody God wants to be killed, am I bad? I mean, of course, it's a famous... It's in Pirkei Avot. It says, remember, there's a skull floating in the water in Pirkei Avot, and the guy says, because of all the people you drowned, that's why you're drowned. But all the people who drowned you will be drowned as well. And that's the famous paradox in Judaism. If God wants you to do it... it's the Mitzrayim paradox, right? Why is God punishing Pharaoh for doing what was destined to happen based on a prophecy to Avram? That's the paradox. If God wants you to be hurt, then anybody who hurts you is doing the act of God. But we don't believe that. So we believe that the person who pulls up trigger and does theoretically what God wanted to happen is doing the wrong thing. But how is that possible? Because he's doing what God wanted to happen, but God didn't want him to pull the trigger. So we excuse it away with Paro. Remember, Paro should have done it, but he did it too meanly. And because he did it too meanly, so he took pleasure in it, so he got punished. But that's just an attempt to resolve the paradox, which is stated in Pirkei Avot, which is, the guy, you died, you wound up in the river because who drowned, and the people who drowned you, even though that's what God theoretically wanted to happen. You could apologize it away another way. God could have let it happen by natural causes, and there's no right for anybody to take the action in the hand of God into their own hands. But the bottom line is, it's still a paradox, and therefore, this section is also paradoxical. Is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? He has a whole bunch of little kids wiped out, all their heads removed. On the other hand, God says, I want you to wipe out the house of Achav. And the Navi does not accuse him of wrongdoing, and that may be those two psukim. Those two psukim where he tells him, you did the right thing, and I didn't kill specifically these people, and God wants to happen anyway, that may be, it may be Yehu's attempt to deal with the paradox of, wow, I'm a murderous guy, but God wanted these guys murdered. It's a moral paradox if you're a good guy, and maybe that's what Pasuk Yud Aleph are trying to deal with, that very moral paradox. I don't want to say Tanakh is a book of pondering philosophy, but it's certainly not a book of pondering philosophy, and maybe that's what those two verses are. But in any event, I think we should go ahead with the story, unless anybody else wants to jump in. Okay, I'll continue. I agree with you. What he does is very harsh. On the other hand, he's taking out the bad guys. It's quite like, it's like vigilante. Is a vigilante a bad guy?
Yeah.
Somebody's a vigilante. Somebody, like, remember those Death Wish movies? Remember those Charles Bronson Death Wish movies? So do you root for Charles Bronson? Is that what's that?
Yeah, I had the wrong quote.
Oh, which quote did you have?
Yeah,
that's Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
Which was also but in Dirty Harry, the bad guys were the vigilantes. The whole idea was those cops were vigilantes taking out the bad people they couldn't deal with in court. And the idea of the movie was, if you don't play by the rules, you wind up being a criminal anyway, and then they kill the cop and Dirty Harry takes care of them. But in that case, the vigilantes are the bad guys. But in the Death Wish movies, it was Charles Bronson was the good guy, and the other guys were clearly in the wrong. So look at there. So that proves, based on Hollywood, that even Hollywood can't figure out whether somebody does the hand, what God wants, is necessarily a good guy, bad guy. So if Hollywood can't figure it out, well, Steven Spielberg wasn't alive at the time. Maybe if Spielberg was alive, he would have, or he was around, maybe he would have figured it out. I think he was doing Jaws at the time, so it was more black and white. I'm sorry, go ahead. What?
So I don't remember how he justified killing the king of Yehuda.
Oh, because King of Yehuda was a brother-in-law, was the son-in-law of Ahav. What we don't know yet, and I think with 20 minutes left, I'm not going to get to it. I was going to take you to Divrei Yamim, which explores the life of poor Ahaziah. We don't meet much of Ahaziah. He comes up, he dies. You know, that's essentially all we got, and they carry him home. We don't really know much about him, but in Divrei Yamim we get a little bit more information. So since we probably won't get there today, he took advice from his mother, Atalia, and it caused him to go off the path, and then he actually got advisors from the north to work for him. So now you had advisors coming down to Yerushalayim to advise him how to live, and he started to essentially live the life of Ahav. So that's how Divrei Yamim paints him. Why does Ezra want to paint him this way? It could be to emphasize exactly, because otherwise you just don't know why this poor schmo should, okay, he's related, but I don't really see what the problem is. So I don't know if we'll get there, but if you get a chance, take a look. It's in chapter 21 of Divrei Yamim, or chapter 22 of Divrei Yamim, Bet. So you take a look, and there it sort of explores the idea that essentially he was a hopeless pawn of the Ahav. Essentially, is as I mentioned before, Israel is uniting under Ahav's house. So you really shouldn't look at Ahaziahu, the son of Yehoram, the son of Yehoshaphat of Yehuda. You shouldn't look at him as a Judean king. In essence, he is really a northern king. And as a son of Ataliah, grandson of Ahav, he's next in line to the throne. Mm. No, not next in line, but he's in line. You follow what I'm saying? Yoram, his father, was married to Ataliah. Ataliah was the daughter of Ahav. Ahaziah, the king of Yehuda, is Ahav's grandson. So with Ahav dead and Yehoram dead, he's on the king from the south is on line for succession. You would normally think, well, that's not so bad, because then we could get Yehuda action up in the north as well, maybe reunite the government with Yehuda. And that's where Divrei Yamim fills in the facts and says it was unsalvageable. Essentially, his house was, Ahaziah was irredeemable. He was a pawn of Ataliah, a pawn of the house of Ahav, and therefore he has to be killed as well. I think Ezra is writing that to help us understand exactly why he did what he did. Wait, it's not over. Also his brothers will die soon also. Yeah, a lot more people. Those are other brothers, but Yehu killed some more brothers also. We're not finished with the death, actually. It's going to continue. Verse 12, something very strange happens. Not very strange, but the pasuk is a little difficult. That's a hard pasuk to translate, but what it essentially means, eked haroim, is probably like ekev haroim, the somewhere where the shepherds would gather, according to Rashi, or according to Radak, somewhere where the shepherds would shear sheep. Keep in mind that this was the money making back then, so it must have been some significant, like a stock exchange, so to speak, some significant place where all the shepherds would come and buy and sell and tie up their sheep and shear their sheep and buy and sell, probably some kind of market or square. What's that? Yeah, exactly right, where there was a big bazaar and going on. So it's a significant place. V'yehu matzat achei Ahaziahu, so who does he find there? But the brothers of Ahaziahu, Melech Yehuda, v'yomer miyatem, he says, hey, who are you? And they do the stupidest thing in the world. Vayomru achei Ahaziah anachnu. Oh, I'll tell you who we are. We're the brothers of Ahaziahu. Bad move. That's like showing your Israeli passport when you get pulled over in Saudi Arabia. That's just take out your American passport is the way to go. So Vanered Lishlom Bnei Amalek, we want to see how everybody's doing. Apparently, the communication, they didn't have cell phones back then. They're on a trip to the north to get a little bit of fresh air from the Yehuda to the north, and they run right into, guess who? They run right into Yehu. Uvnei HaGvira. Now, that's very important. We want to see the children of the children of the king. What's interesting, the question is, which king? My guess is they're referring to the king of the north. The king of the north, whose name is Yoram. And the reason why I'm saying this is that because look how they refer to Izebel. She's the Gvira. That's another indication that the children of Yehuda consider their king to be Achav's son, Yehoram, and the woman who's the Gvira, which is a famous title of, you know, essentially the mother of the king, who's the second most powerful king and person in Mesopotamian dynasties, and in Israel also, as we know from Shlomo's mother. She sat on the throne right next to him. So essentially they call Izebel the Gvira. Again, this is to give you an indication that there's no hope for the southern kings. It's not like somehow they could pull a Jehoshaphat and come back to God. They are hopelessly enthralled. They're essentially now simply adjunct to the northern kingdom of Omri Achav. Vayomer tifsum chayim, go grab them alive. That's a very similar expression that we've seen before. Vayitfsum chayim, they grab them alive. Vayishchatum, and then they kill them. El bor beit eked arba'im u'shnayim ish. They kill 42 people. Velo hishir ish mehem, they leave nobody alive. So there, that takes care of all of Ahaziah's relatives. I would guess everybody who's related in any way to Ahab, but who was living in the south, were foolish enough to come on a little vacation trip to the north, where they walked right into Yehu's hands. Vayelech misham, and he goes from there, Vayimtzat Yonadab ben Rechav l'krato. Now, we've never heard of Yehonadab ben Rechav. Ahaziah goes, and Yehu goes and he finds a guy named Yehonadab ben Rechav. The theory is, now here's a problem with writing. A writer expects people to know, have access to historical books, and to know who's power players at the time. Since there's no introduction to Yehonatan ben Rechav, my guess is at least expected, oh yeah, that's like, you know, now if I say George Bush, we'll know what's going on. We'll see what happens, you know, if I say Chester Garfield, is that the name?
Chester Arthur.
Chester Arthur. So that proves my point, actually. That proves my point. So, you know, you don't always know people. What? Where is it near me?
In
Jeremiah.
Chapter 34, verse 2.
This is a new one on me. 34, verse 2.
In what sefer?
In Jeremiah. Hadavar shayal Yirmiyahu mi'eit Hashem Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel ki chelu kol melechot eretz mentzotel yadol kol amim nilchamim al Yushalayim kol arayah. So first of all, we're 200 years later. This is 200 years. Kol amar Hashem lehi Yisrael halof amar to tzikiyahu melech Yudah go to liv amar to lav kol amar Hashem hini noten et ha'ir azot b'yad melech Bavel. Did you say 34 too?
It's not here.
Yeah, but it's not here.
It's not here.
I don't got a Rechav here. Yehonadab and Rechav. So. Well, that makes sense because those chapters are just lineage. This guy got bored to this one. That's a mistake. 34-2. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I could, if I had a computer here, we could just look up Rechav. I didn't think to do it. I don't know. His name is certainly not known from. There is a Rechav Bat Bana. So there's another guy named Rechav. I think it's a reasonably popular name. That's probably.
Thirty-two.
You guys make up your mind. 35. Yeah. Yehalochel beit Rechavim. Go to the house of the Rechavim. It could be.
35.
Oh, pasuk. 35. Yonadav and Rechav. Yeah, they became Nazirim, but the question is why. I'll tell you.
Must have detested the luxurious surroundings of the royal family, and so Yehu saw in him a sympathetic ally.
We're going to see that alliance right now. But why would he give up wine? They became essentially Nazirim. The whole became a house of Nazirim. What caused him to become a Nazirim? That's what I was thinking. Also, of course, there's no. Because of the excesses of Yehu?
No, the excesses of...
Oh, you mean he was already a Nazir when he met up with Yehu?
Yes.
Okay. I could have given you another possibility, which is after he did all of the bloody revolution of Yehu, I think we need more information. So believe that, I'll do research. I'll look up as much Chazal on it as I can. I didn't think to do it. My mistake. Also look up the Divrei Yamin. Sometimes there are clues there because they're saying that he's the descendant of, he's a convert, which is also interesting. Rechav is not a Jewish name, but Yehonadav is. So it could be that he converted to full Judaism from his father. So we'll have to take a look. Next week we'll do the research. Now we'll see that essentially he's a military leader. And he's willing to go along, and he fought alongside Yehu, and he's willing to go along with Yehu. So that will get us through this chapter, but next time I will do more research on who Yonatan ben Rechav is. In any event, Tetvav, Vayivarcheyu, he blesses him, Vayomer Elav. This is one of those things that annoys Herb, I know. He says to him, but it never says who's saying to who. So Radak helps us out. I mean, it becomes obvious, but it's certainly not absolutely clear. It is Yehu speaking to Yehonadab. He says, Hayeshet levavcha yashar kasher levavi im levavecha. Are you loyal to me like I was loyal to you? Now that sounds like Rechab was a powerful guy. Right? It's Hayesh et levavcha yashar, is your heart straight? Kasher levavi im levavecha, like my heart is close to your heart. It's a little unclear what that means. It sounds, in a simple sense, it sounds like they were originally soldiers together. Rechav was some kind of significant family, and Yehu is saying, I'm on your side. That is, you're not an enemy to me. I've always been your friend. Now the question is, are you going to treat me the same? Obviously, Rechav was powerful enough that it made a difference to Yehu. Vayomer Yonatav, yesh vayesh. Yes and yes. Tznat yadecho, give me your hand. Vayitein yad vayaleo el merkava. He pulls him up, a real nice gesture of pulls him up into his chariot, and they ride off together, not into the sunset, but they ride off, and we'll see where they go. The word yesh vayesh is a little bit strange because he didn't ask him two things; he only asked him one thing. Which means I agree with you about your heart, and now I want you to know that my heart is your heart. Is that what you're saying?
No. He's saying, like my heart is with you.
He said, "Is your heart with me like my heart is with you?"
Levavi
im levavecha.
Is your heart to me like my heart is to you? And he's saying both hearts are the same. Yesh for yesh.
Okay.
That could be Lashon Shua. He's swearing.
Could be a swear. Radak, of course, says a slightly more straightforward answer, which is sometimes you duplicate things for the sake of emphasis. And don't be confused by the vav. Vav does not. Raining cats and dogs neither means that it's raining cats and dogs, nor is the and there of any I am sick and tired. When you have euphemism, sometimes the vav simply drops out. Another example is tohu vavohu. It's not really this and that. It was all one big tohu vavohu situation.
I always thought when it was raining cats and dogs that both cats and dogs were coming down.
No.
Yeah. Sure.
Are you just giving me a hard time? I don't know.
No.
All right,
truly, I don't think cats.
I have another example in Bereishit. I will greatly. God says to the woman, "I will greatly increase your pain of childbirth and your pregnancy." How could God increase her? It's hayronech. It's etzbonech veheryonech. I will increase your pain and your pregnancy. I hate to get Christological here. Let's avoid from Christological issues here. Although I'm sure
there's a pain of childbirth and there's a pain of carrying.
No, I don't think that's it's what's called. It's just an expression. The vav there is just. And by the way, the indication is take a look under the vav. There's also something funny under the vav, which also indicates that there's something going on. If you look under this vav, you'll see that there is a yesh, not v'yesh, but yesh v'yesh. That va, when you take a look in Tanakh, as you're reading on in Parsha and Torah, look out for that va. It's very strange. It usually indicates not so much an and as simply a unification of ideas rather than specifically yesh v'yesh. So I like how I like your idea. It certainly can be yesh your heart, yesh my heart.
If you read the beginning of the pasuk, the earlier in the pasuk before, so that's earlier in the pasuk. Okay, hayesh et levavecha yashar. After kasher, there's an implicit yesh there.
Really? Kasher yesh levavim levavecha.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's very implicit. You don't have to. I don't have to have a yesh to have it there.
No, but I'm saying that's what.
Okay. So you're saying that essentially it's responding to both sides of the other parallel. Okay, certainly possible. Yes, absolutely. Tetzayin. Vayomer lecha iti, come with me, re'ei b'kinati la'adonai, and go with my zealousy to God. Not jealousy, the zealous is much better. V'arkiveo tol b'rechbo, he rode him on his chariot. Vayavo shomron, vayach ha'kol, nishayim achav shomron, ad hishmido, kidvar adonai asher diber liyahu. Now this is prat and klal. This kasher diber Eliyahu matches up to the previous kasher diber Eliyahu, which was in pasuk yud. Well, it's all over the place. It's in yud aleph a little bit. It's that's where he attacked them. Where else does he say he killed them? Like Eliyahu said in yud, right? Kasher diber Eliyahu. So this is one of those things where it's actually happening. This is a nice piece of what happens in the Tanakh. You don't get parentheses. You don't get footnotes. What happens? You have two things going on at the same time. So what you do is you usually tie them in with certain words, like Kasher Diber Eliyahu, and that indicates that essentially those psukim that ended off with Kasher Diber Eliyahu are going on more or less parallel. So while he's going through this revolution, one of the things that he managed to get together was Yehonadab and Rechab, who was obviously the significant person, even though we've never heard of him here. We have a few minutes, so let's see if we get to the next bloody piece. I'll try to go through it quickly. Yehu Yavdenu Harbe. He says to all the people in the north, he says, Achav used to pray a little bit to the Baal, but I'm really, really, really going to pray to the Baal. He is, of course, lying. Va'ata kol nevi'a Baal kol avadav kol kohanav kiru alai. Get together all of the priests of the Baal. Al yipakeid, don't let one slip away, is essentially how to translate that, I think. Ki zevach gadoli labal, because I'm making a big feast for the Baal, an inauguration feast, and I'm a Baal man. Now, of course, he's theoretically a Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei man, but they don't know about the prophet coming to him because he ran away as fast as possible, which is another reason probably why the prophet came in, said the words inside a room, and then slipped out as fast as he could, because essentially you don't want to publicize his connection with God because it allows him to do something Eliyahu was never able to do. Right? Remember at Eliyahu's big showdown on Har Carmel, and he managed to kill 450 of them, but obviously there are a lot left. What Eliyahu was not able to do, Yehu will do by pretending to be a Baal worshipper himself. He is a very sneaky guy, to be perfectly honest, and that should probably influence us understanding for all the psukim. Whoever doesn't come will die. Right? V'ya'akveni zeh pa'amayim, Esav says about Yaakov. He tricked me these two times. V'ya'akveni be'okba, he healed me. Or he was, you don't want to say he's a heal. That's not a good translation. But he tricked me these two, L'man ha'avid et ovdei ha'baal, he's all doing it. Now, by the way, this is a prophetic little insert. I guess the prophet's worried that you might be fooled into thinking that he's had a quick thing, so the prophet slips in this, essentially this half a pasuk to let you know that it's all fake, just relax. Maybe he's afraid that people are about to slam the book shut, like, oh no, I can't read the rest of the story if he's going to be a traitor. So it's okay, it's all a trick, you could read on. Sort of like reading the last page in a mystery novel. It relaxes you a little bit if you're that type of person, so you can read on. Chaf, v'yomer yehu kad shua atzara l'baal, v'yikrau. So call a holiday. There's the word atzar, like atzeret yelachem, which we have in ours. Essentially, you always hear pulpit sermons about the word atzeret. What does it mean to stop? Well, we stop our celebrate. Yeah, it's like a famous pulpit speech. You ever heard a pulpit speech on the word atzeret? I've heard a dozen of them. So here, the bottom line is, it's all nice pulpit speeches, but atzeret means a holiday. Why? Because it means a gathering together of people, like Moed, Yom Moed. What is Yom Moed? It's a day that everybody gets together to congregate, right? Like Ohol Moed, and that's what's going on here. Vayishlach Yehu b'chol Yisrael v'yavol kol avdei ha'baal. So everybody's very excited. They all get together for this really big holiday. V'lo nishar isha shelo ba. Everybody came. Whoever, it was like a party. Every who's who came to the party. Nobody left behind. What's that?
Yeah, knowing, having had that parenthetical that there was a trick.
Yeah.
It's always comical to read these passages.
It is. I think, you mean because the prophet is making fun, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Comical in what way?
It's so comical. They all came out.
Yeah.
Didn't they know what was going to happen?
Well, I think they may have believed that he was... Look, you probably think that he's going to be a Baal worshiper. Why would you think that this guy named Yehu, who just killed his king, won't be a Baal worshiper?
Because he said...
I mean, people are always convinced that their religion... What's that? Because
he said this all happened the way Eliyahu said it would.
That's true. It's a good point.
There's no, mass communication. People didn't know that.
That's true also. So you got... there's no mass communication. So it's not... You know, it's like you can pick up a newspaper and see... What's that saying?
Yeah, time here is very nebulous.
But this has to take time because he's sending messengers throughout the whole land.
But I think it's back a little bit by Rechav. You can see Rechav's involved in this whole process also. So it may be running in parallel. There's another possibility. People are gullible. The other possibility is he put out a king's order, which means I am a big Baal person, but if you don't come, I'm going to kill you. So good news, bad news. Also keep in mind, as I've said often, the word call, everybody, doesn't always mean call. It usually means majority. And as we'll see, there are a few more Baal worshippers afterwards. Even though it says there was nobody that didn't come, you could also translate Ish as... the way we do by he ish me ramatayim sofim. It doesn't just mean every single one, but it means all the significant players. That is, all of the cardinals and above came. And that's a good way to translate ish. It doesn't necessarily really mean man. It means significant man. I'm just going to get to the bloody part, and then we'll stop. Vayimalei beit Baal pelepeh. And the house of Baal, which if you remember Achav built in Shomron, was crowded. It was standing room only. It was like the ABJB dinner. Everybody was there, and it was arm to arm. Vayomer l'asher al ameltacha. So he tells to the person who's in charge of the clothes. Now meltacha is a very difficult word. The reason why we know it's the person in charge of the clothes is for the rest of the pasuk. Hotze levus l'chol of de'abal. Bring out clothes for all the worsters of the baal. Vayotze lehem amalbush. Give them clothes. Now, why do you want to give them clothes? Because you want to be able to identify them when you're about to kill them. So he wants to put a special thing. But they're not going to want to take on special clothes. Isn't the attention to detail is just unbelievable. It's such an Elisha Parsha, the attention to detail. Normally, I think if Eliyahu was writing this, he'd be like, and I killed them all. And that's what happened. But here, he gets them to dress up. How does he get them to dress up? He tells you how he gets them to dress up without being suspicious. Vayavo Yehu v'yonadav ben rechav beit habal. He specifically had Yonadav. Now, by the way, this is a good indication that Yonadav was already a religious extremist, or a religious asset at the time, because he got him involved in the killing of the Baal. It was probably Rechav's men, Yonadav's men, who were more comfortable with killing unarmed Baal. Their idea of some people, were acrimonical, let them daven the way they want to daven. But if Yonadav is how he's described, I could see where Yonadav would not take mercy. You have to dress up in these clothes. I want you to get undressed and then redressed because I want to see if there are any spies here. My guess is that they would be circumcised as opposed to the Baals who would not be circumcised. How else would you know by somebody undressing and redressing that they were Jewish? Do they have the word Yud-Kei Vav-Kei spelled on them like Madonna has or something? I don't know if you saw the video where she has the Lav, Lamed Aleph, Vav, either tattooed or charcoaled onto her arms. It was a pretty famous MTV video. So my guess is that they look for the circumcision. They check people, check their identity papers to see whether they were Baal worshippers. Baal worshippers probably did not circumcise, almost for sure did not circumcise, and Hashem worshippers for sure did.
I thought a lot of the Jews in Shomron were Baal
worshippers. Yeah, but they certainly were not circumcising.
But
if there were Jews there, my guess is they were probably a minority. Ezebel's got all of her forces down there. My guess is it's been 50 years. Nobody who's essentially a significant player in the Baal worship has a... No way. It's just not... And there were Jews. It seems shocking to us. Like, who knows a Jew, no matter how unaffiliated you are? Every Jew has a circumcision. This is... We're talking about... What? Oh, sorry. So not one, but I want you to know something. I actually heard about this guy. He's a Jewish guy, and Jewish guys are always the most gorgeous. So he had a circumcision when he was young, and he wants it back. So he's actually doing some kind of surgery in order to get it back. So I want you to know something. There's always you heard of it? You heard of this?
Yeah.
There's this group now. There's this anti-circumcision. We want it back. A group. Oh, that's my Omer thing. I'm sorry. Hold on. Yeah, this way I never. I'd like to say that I rarely forget to say the Omer all the way through, and I'd like to say it's because of my responsibility, but it's really because of my computer. Sorry. Let me just put it away. It is already 9:05, and I don't want to go more. I'd be rushing these psukim just to just just to let you know what happens, as if you're not surprised, they kill everybody. And then whoever they don't get, they go out and get some. They go out and get some more. And then we'll get to, that'll take us to Pasuk. Next time I'll skim quickly through those Pasukim, and then in Pasuk Lamed, we'll finish up the chapter, then go on to crazy Atalia. Now, Atalia was the daughter of Ahab. When she finds out about the revolution, she says, the only way to save my personal throne is have every male child of the house of Yehoshaphat destroyed. And that's what she does, except she misses somebody. So we'll continue. We're almost finished with the revolution. We'll finish off the bloody revolution. And then we'll get, actually, the focus will shift down to the south. And we'll see how Atalia's evil plots do not succeed more than 6 years. Oh, they turned it into a toilet. Oh, so since you mentioned, I have to show you that word. It's very interesting. I'm sorry. Where is that verse?
This really was a complete foul reception.
That is very funny. I'm going to steal that at some point. I hope you don't mind. Verse 27? Yeah, they take the city. Verse 27. Are you sure verse 27?
Yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, there's an interesting word there. The original word is limcharaot. By the way, that word, I shouldn't even say it really, because it's a curse. Chet resh ayin, aleph, is the Israeli from the Arabic curse word for feces, essentially. It's like saying the English S word, and it was a bad word back then because there's a Kri and a Ktiv, and it says limotsaot, for that which comes out of the body. But essentially, they did, Yehu was that type of guy, or maybe Yonadab and Rechab was that type of guy. They took the place, they knocked it down, they turned it into a big mass outdoor toilet. It's just Elisha written all over it. He's just got a certain flair to him of details, which you have to laugh about or cringe about. It's just I think it's a beautifully written little piece, and we'll continue on next time. 8:15, we'll do 8:15 next time. I'll send out a letter because davening will certainly be over probably about by 8:10 to 8:15. We'll be able to take on from there, and then we'll read Valerie. Have a good night. Thank you very much for coming.